the most expensive place that they could be staying.
Well, they paid for it, don't worry about it. You want a bungalow?
We
pay
for it.
I'm not even paying for my own bungalows.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to reinforce that they shouldn't be doing that. That's a thing that, while it has become normalized, is bad. And it's okay to not want a president that will use the power of the office and the responsibility of running a country to personally enrich himself.
It's good for you. It's good for you to want better for yourself. It's good for me. It's good for all of us to want more for ourselves. And on that note, just think of sweet bungalows and, you know, trees just rustling in the wind and birds chirping. Sonia, thank you very much. Althea, thank you. I'm Tammy. This has been The Gap. Hope you all have a great rest of the day.
Thanks.
That's right. This is KBOO Portland. It's creeping up on 9 a.m., at which point we will have...
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Veterans Voice with your host, Marvin. So stay tuned.
We recorded this song on October the 6th. Since then, the war has been declared over. If you're like me, you'll remember it like anybody remembers any war. One big drag. A lot of people write songs about wars and government. Very social things. But I think about young guys who were like I was when I was young. I had no more idea about any government or political things or anything. And I think about those kind of young guys now who all of a sudden somebody comes up and they're very law-abiding. So if somebody says go, they don't ask any questions, they just go. And I can remember not too long ago seeing a young guy with his right arm gone. Just got back. And I asked him how he was doing. He said he was doing all right now, but he had thought he was gonna die. He said getting shot at didn't bother him. It was getting shot that shook him up. And I tried to put myself in his position. Maybe he cried. Maybe he said, I can't write left-handed. Would you please write a letter? Write a letter to my mother. Tell her to tell, tell her to tell, tell her to tell her family lawyer. Trying to get a deferment for my younger brother. Tell the Reverend Harris to pray for me, Lord, Lord, Lord. I ain't gonna live. I don't believe I'm gonna live to get much older. hold of us. Strange little man over here in Vietnam. I ain't never seen. Bless his heart, I ain't never done nothing to. He done shot me in my shoulder. Boot camp, we had classes. You know we talked about fighting, fighting every day. And looking through rosy colored glasses. I must admit it seemed exciting. In a way, but something that they overlooked to tell me, Lord, bullets look better, I must say. At you, but go it out the other way. And please call up the Reverend, call up the Reverend Harris. Tell him to ask the Lord to do some good things for me, Lord. Oh. Tell him I ain't gonna live to get much older. Shot me in my shoulder.
Portland calling. Sisters and brothers, welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 104.3 FM Corvallis, and 91.9 FM Hood River, or on the World Wide Web at KBOO.FM. You can also hear our earlier shows, if you like, on KBOO.FM/Veterans Voice. I'm Marvin, and Sonia is engineering the show today, and I appreciate it. That song by Bill Withers, he was a Navy veteran during the war in Vietnam, and so, you know, he saw a lot of guys coming back that were wounded and really hurt bad. A lot of the wounds in Vietnam were gunshot wounds, but there were also lots of them were from booby traps that, you know, took took guys' legs off from the knees down. And I just don't know. My cousin Bill was a combat medic for the AmeriCal, and I just don't know how he did it, you know, how he's so sane today. But he does have a lot of problems with PTSD. Now, there's a lot of things I want to talk about today, and I want to say how wonderful June 19th was, Juneteenth. The shows on KBOO were so wonderful, and I'm glad I gave up my spot so my brothers and sisters could use my hour, and they did a wonderful job, and I'm really, really happy that I let them have my spot. I'm going to talk a little bit about things. I've been downtown quite a few times watching what's going on downtown. I went down yesterday again, but I went down in the daytime this time and looked around and saw what was happening. And there's still a lot of people down there, even though the city blocked off the two parks right in front of the front of the Marco Hatfield building. They got these barriers up around it, and they have cops inside and watching them and everything. And I walked by and looked at all the writings on the walls of the federal building. When I first got there and drove in front of the buildings to find a parking spot, there were a lot of people right out in front of it, with a lot of the federal cops were out front, not only in their war uniforms, you know, with their stuff on, but also there was a lot of guys there in their suits and ties standing around. And by the time I got around and found a place to park, they had gone back in, and the crowd had moved away a little bit. They moved down to the corner by the federal building, and they were doing this, had their signs and everything out. And there was a group of, I'd say four women and a couple of men had that blue flag, support the police thing. You know, they had a flag with the blue line and all that, and they were standing there, and the people were talking to them. And there's one guy there, you know, he was a cop. He had a haircut and a whole bit, and he was being, you know, they were going really after him, and he didn't make any sense, the things he was saying. And when they started going, it's getting kind of hot there, some of the cops from across the street came over by the stop sign there, stoplight there, and were waiting and had their clubs and all that stuff. And I was sitting on this post watching, and there was a guy sitting next to me, and we were talking and everything, and he asked me what I thought about it. I told him, I'm sick and tired of this police violence against the, you know, my brothers and sisters, you know. And we were talking, and he got walked across the street and went up to the cop with a shaved head and was talking to him, and he pointed at me, you know, and went back and said something to them, and just a few minutes later they walked away. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool, you know. And he come back over, and I told him he didn't support him. And I said, well, that's true. And then he stayed with me for a little while, and we talked, and as I was walking back, I went back in front of the federal not the federal building, but the Marco Hatfield building, and those cops had all gone inside, and there was one guy in a suit, and he was standing there, and I said, do you know how to stop all this, don't you? And he said, well, good afternoon, or something like that, real snotty. And I said, stop killing black people. And he just stood there, and he just looked at me, and I said, stop killing black people, man. And then I walked around and went back up to where my car was parked, and along the street there was just a whole bunch of people sitting around. They'd set up a table with water and food and everything, and they were sitting around, and I was talking to them for a little while, and then I cut back over to where my truck was, and there was like three cops in this park on this side, and there was a bunch on the other side. And then there was one up by the fence I'd put up by my truck, my car. And I said, you know, you guys stop killing black people. That's all you got to do. Just stop killing black people. Well, that's not all they have to do, but stop killing black people. And the one guy cop, he said, I didn't kill anybody. And I says, yeah, but you're protecting the people who do. And he didn't have anything more to say. He just, you know, kind of just started talking to the cop next to him. And then I walked around to get into my truck. And there was another cop standing there closer to the fence. And I said the same thing to him. And he just shook his head yes. And then I left. But I was thinking about this whole, you know, this whole mess that this whole cop thing, you know, of the violence that they do to people, just the horrific violence to people who, you know, have done really nothing. And the killing of our black brothers and sisters is just completely out of hand. Just completely out of hand. They've just got to do something. You know, get these cops under control. And then when they brought these federal people in, those people, they got the ear of that man that sits in the People's Oval Office. And they, you know, when they shot that kid in the head with the less than lethal weapon, when he was just standing there, and I think he had a speaker over his head, and his arms were up, and they shot him in the head. And I thought that there it is, right there. You know, they have no respect, because everybody's out there saying stop killing black people, and they don't care. They don't seem to care. And I was thinking, you know, somebody, that guy didn't just shoot on his own, and someone probably had to tell him to shoot. And they're not supposed to shoot at your head, but they shot this kid. And I was thinking, you know, what if they were trying to shoot that speaker out of his hands, you know, just to make a point, and they shot him in the face instead? That just shows you how cruel and just how cruel those people can be. And I've been following the days I can't go downtown, or the nights I can't go downtown. I've been watching this guy who's been streaming. I tried to get a hold of him, but I wasn't able to get a hold of him to talk to him today. His name's Eric Goodwood, and he's been having every night, I think, almost every night, he's been down there and streaming what's been going on. And if you really want to watch, if you can't go downtown, or you don't feel safe going downtown, you can look it up. I'm pretty sure it's on YouTube. You can put his name in, Eric Goodwood, and you can see some of the stuff he's put on the internet. It's really, really good. I wish I could have got a hold of him for today. He's a veteran, and his webpage is Veteran for Peace, not Veterans, but Veteran for Peace. So if you can put that in and Google or whatever you use, and it'll come up and show what the stuff he's been having on the internet. And you can see the violence that those cops do. I guess last night they really went crazy and arrested a whole bunch of people. So they think that by you know, blocking off the two parks, that's going to, you know, slow them down. But it's not, you know, it's just not going to slow people down. There's just no way around it. They're not going to do that. And because people are angry about what's been going on, and they've just you know, the cops have just got way, you know, too long, got away with what they've been doing with no time in prison for killing innocent people. And you have to give those people downtown are revolutionary, you know, comrades of ours. All you, everyone listening to KABU, understands what's going on and what has to be done, and how to support people that are on the front lines, showing that we're not going to put up with what's been going on. And I thought back about, you know, I'm getting too old to really be in the middle of it anymore. So I try to help as much as I can in other ways. And I was thinking back about when I did stuff, you know. I've been doing stuff since I was a kid. And one of the things that really got me going on race relations, when I was in high school, I think I was like a sophomore in high school, and we got a new teacher. She hadn't taught, this is her first year of teaching, and she was teaching in the English class. We had an English class, and we had, she came up with a list of books that she thought that we should read. And I, you know, I looked at the list, and there were things like, you know, just stuff we'd already read when, you know, when we were kids and everything. And I'd already read all those books, and because I like to read a lot. When you're a poor kid, you want to read, you want to learn, you know, because schools weren't really helping poor kids. You know, they were just like, here, get, you know, go on or whatever, you know. And so I read a lot. And I was looking down the list of books, and I saw a name that I'd never heard before, and it was James Baldwin. And I thought, wow, this is interesting, James Baldwin. And so I asked this young teacher, you know, who's James Baldwin? And she said, he's a black writer. He just writes these wonderful books, and he's, you know. And I thought, wow, I'm gonna read one of these books that she has. And it was so, you know, I started looking at the list of some of the books she has, and I came up with trying to decide what book I wanted to read. And I didn't know anything about him. And he was a playwright. He was an American novelist. He was a playwright. He was an essayist. He's a poet, and he was an activist. And he came from. He was born in Harlem in 1924, and he was a small man. He was like 5'6", and he was a gay man. And I thought, wow, this is going to be interesting. So the book that I chose was, he had a bunch of essays that they had collected and put it in a book called Notes of a Native Son, and it was published in 1955. And it was so interesting. It just explored racial and sexual and class distinction in Western society, being in the mid 20th century, being a black gay man. And I thought, oh, this is just going to, you know, I've never heard of anything like that. And I think if the school board would have found out what books she had, they'd have probably wanted to stop her from having that book. But that book just changed my whole life, my whole thinking about things, you know. Because here in Oregon, you know, we weren't around a lot, you know, unless you lived in Portland, and weren't around people of color. You know, I didn't know that much about it. But when I started reading that book, I thought, oh man, this is good. And he also wrote some really great books: The Fire Next Time, No Name in the Street. He wrote The Devil Finds Work, and he wrote I Am Not Your Negro. And a book, one of his books had just gotten, I think it got made into a film not that long ago. It was called If Beale Street Could Talk. And Beale Street, if it, it is a street in Nashville down by Music Row where they have you know, all these clubs that play the blues and everything. It's really fun to go down there. I've been down there a few times. And his novels and everything is just, you know, so great, because at the time he was writing, he wrote, you know, he wrote about the civil rights movement, gay liberation. He wrote a lot of just wonderful things. And he died December of 1987. He was only 63 years old. And he had left this country and he had moved to France. And he lived in France until the day he died. And these books, if you've never read anything by James Baldwin, it's just amazing. He's just such a great writer. And the things he wrote back, you know, in the late 50s and the 60s fits right into today, what's going on in this country today. And I would suggest that, you know, that if you have time, that you should look up James Baldwin and read him, and it just gives you an insight into what's going on. Like I said, it really changed my life, because I didn't know anything about, you know, the black movement in this country, because I was a kid in Oregon. So I thought that would be really good for people to read. And there's so many other great, you know, black writers, you know, Maya Angelou, and just so many black writers that we never got a chance when we were kids. We never really got a chance to read them. And so I just think that these books by Baldwin would really be great to, great for people to hear. I mean, hear to read, and it made me into an activist pretty fast, because I started empathizing with people, you know. And then when I have I remember watching. We had an old black and white Emerson television, and we would watch the news where people in the South were just fighting for their rights, you know. You know, the government doesn't give you rights. You have to take them. You know, they're your rights, but they're not just going to say, here's some rights. You want them? You have to take them from them. And that's what the people in the South were doing, my black sisters and brothers in the South were doing. And they were getting beat. They were getting fire hosed. They were having dogs sicked on them. And then I remember sitting there watching this, and my mother and father are from Missouri. And I remember looking up at my mom and saying, why are these people being beat? Being beat, Mom. And my mother looked at me and she says, because they want their rights. And that just stuck with me till this day. And I see what's happening now. It's the same thing, that the people are fighting for their rights. And this time, they're getting a lot more support from the communities. You know, when you see huge crowds supporting the black movement now that you didn't see in the past, it's just amazing, you know. Tens of thousands of people in the streets all over this country and around the world. And Portland is right there in the middle of it, boy. We're right in the middle of it. You know, we support the Black Lives Matter movement, and Sonia, I think I'd like you to start the next song for me.
You got it.
If you could do that. Okay, thank you. This is one of my favorite songs.
Arise, ye workers, from your slumbers. Arise, ye prisoners of want. For reasoning hold now thunders, and at last ends the age of cant. Away with all your superstition, servile masses, arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition, we'll spurn the dust to win the prize. Also, comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. Also, comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. No more the goodbye reaction. On tyrants only we'll make war. The soldiers too will take strike action. They'll break ranks, they'll fight no more. And if those cannibals keep trying to sacrifice us to their pride, they soon shall hear the bullets flying. We'll shoot the generals on our own side. Also, comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. Also, comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. No savior from on high delivers. No faith have we in Prince of Peace. Our own right hand, the chains must shiver. Chains of hatred, greed, and fear. Ere the thieves will out with their booty and give to all a happier lot. Each at the forge must do their duty, and will strike while the iron is hot. Also, comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. Also, comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. The Internationale unites the human race.
Now that's a song for all working people. If you receive a paycheck, you're a working person. No matter where you are, you're a working person. And we've got to all stick together to make this world better. Right now, you know, all the money's going up, and away from us. And, you know, I just heard the other day that one of these multimillionaire billionaires just made a whole bunch of billions more dollars while the rest of people, you know, people are worrying about, you know, not getting their jobs back. They're worrying about being kicked out of their homes. You know, that this is a rich country. I mean, that shouldn't be happening. And, you know, that the Internationale is one of my favorite songs. And I think that it fits right into what's going on today. When I was listening to KBOO last month on Juneteenth, I started thinking about my friends that I did a lot of anti-racist and a lot of anti-police violence back in the South, and with Danny and Frank and Danny's sister Carol, and I thought that, you know, I haven't talked with them for a long time. And so I called back to Danny's father's house to see if I could get Danny's phone number, and the phone was answered. It was by Danny's mother, and his father had passed away, and his father was a NAM vet, and he was a lifer, so he was pretty old when he went to Vietnam. And so she gave me Danny's number, and Danny had moved up into New York City. And we talked about the things we'd done and about how we were each getting along, and how he is a part of the Black Lives Matter movement up there. And he, you know, he said he was older and a little slower than he had been, And but he was really, you know, doing a lot of work up there, because he really did a lot of work when we were together working down in the South. And he'd gotten married. He's had a couple children who were grown and out of the house now. And he had graduated from Tennessee State University. So he told me he was working for it, but I can't remember exactly who it was. And he talked about how big the movement was, the Black Lives Matter movement was in New York City, and how that he really felt comfortable working with them, to have so many black folk around him, you know, like when we were down in the South working, you know, we were, you know, worked a lot. And Danny, he says that I asked him, you know, do you remember when you were growing up, did you get a lot of racist slurs hollered at you or whatever? And he says, well, I lived in Nashville, didn't I? And we talked about that, and he said that when he went to college, that a lot of stuff, you know, changed in him, and he became really, really an activist. And I thought that was, you know, we talked for a long time, and then I asked him if he had any contact with Frank. Frank was another black buddy of mine, and Frank and Danny and I had went up to D.C. For the inauguration of a Democrat or something, and we did a lot of stuff up there at that time, and we drove from Nashville to D.C. and we drove at night, most of the time at night, because in the South, one time Danny and Frank and Carol, Danny's sister, were going down to some town in Alabama to be part of a protest down there against police brutality. And as I was driving, and Danny was in the front seat and Frank and Carol were in the back seat, so we're just going along and I'm sticking right to the limit, you know, and boy, a cop pulled, as soon as we crossed that line, boy, a cop pulled us over and took my driver's license and all that, and where are you going, where are you coming from, and everything. And he asked Frank and Carol and Danny, where you guys going, what are you up to, you know, and all this stuff, and he was really ignorant. And so we decided, if we're going to make some trips, we're going to do it, because we'd been pulled over before, even in Tennessee, we'd been pulled over before. So we made the decision that we'd travel if we had to by night, and if we did it by day, that I would be in the back seat, you know. And I remember stopping at a gas station. We was coming back from D.C. or Greensboro. I think we coming back. Maybe it was Greensboro that we were coming back. And we stopped at a gas station to get gas. And Danny and Frank got out. This other guy, I can't remember his name, who had gone with us, it got out. And so I was waiting for somebody to come back to be by the car before I got out. And so I got out and I walked over to the bathroom. And by the time I got back in, there was a cop pulled in behind our car. And, you know, the gas station attendant called the cops on us, you know. So and cop was asking us the same stupid questions. Where are you going? Where are you, you know, what are you up to and all this stuff? And finally, he just let us go, and we came back home. But that happened a lot. I remember going into a restaurant in Knoxville, Tennessee. The four of us went into a restaurant, and we ordered our food and everything, and they made us pay before they served us our food. They made us pay. So it goes to show. Goes to show. And I asked Frank, I tried to call Frank. The number that Danny had gave me for Frank was in Jamaica, New York, was where Frank was from, because when we went to the convention up there, we stayed at Frank's mom and dad's house. And they were, boy, they were nice people. They were really nice people. And And they gave, you know, they just treated me really good and treated everybody really good. And they really fed us good food. And I called up and I asked him, I said, do you have an address for Frank? And the mother said that Frank had died and that he had gotten cancer and Frank had died. And I asked her, about did Frank have a family? He had gotten married. He had some children. And he had graduated from Duke University, and she said that that when he passed away, that they'd brought his ashes back up to New York, and that I told her I was very sad I told her who I was, and she said, "Oh, you were the white guy. You were the white guy with Frank and those guys." And I said, "Yeah, that was me." And we talked just a little bit longer, and I told her, I'm really sorry about Frank. And so she thanked me and everything. And it was really sad because Frank was really a good guy, and he was a good guy. And when I had talked to Danny, I asked him about Carol, and he said Carol was doing fine. She had she's married and she has children, but she's still part of the movement. And Carol was a wonderful, wonderful woman. And she had been working when we were doing our stuff and anti-racist and anti-police violence, she was working for these two attorneys, these two white attorneys who were really liberal. And they would let us use their machine to make copies. They would let us have meetings in their place, and they were just really, really nice. And they, and Carol was working for them while she was going through Tennessee State. And a caller called in and he wanted to tell, I made a mistake. I said that Beale Street was in Nashville, but it's in Memphis. And I want to thank him for calling in. And I just misspoke. It is in Memphis, and it's a great place. Great place to go visit is Beale Street. It's wonderful. But Carol and I used to, with Frank sometimes and with Danny sometimes, or would go out in teams of two and would put up these flyers, these big, sometimes they were big posters and sometimes they were smaller posters about police violence and the racism that was going on, because we also belonged to Nashville Coalition of Concerned Citizens, which is just made up of different groups in the Nashville area, including Fisk University, which is a black college, and also Meharry Medical, which is a black medical school right in Nashville. And we would go there, and the students would help us design these flyers and everything. And sometimes they would go out with us and they would also put up these flyers and everything. And if we got, sick or something, we had friends at the medical school who would take care of us. And I thought that, that was really cool. And so Carol and I would make what was called starch paste. And starch paste is really good for putting up flyers because it's really hard to take them down. And what you do is you get cornstarch and you put water in it and you heat it up, and you can get it off the net, and it's really good for it's really good because it like I said, it's my computer just went crazy on me. There it is. And you can make it on your stovetop. So we'd make about a gallon at a time, and we had it in a bucket with a lid on it. Then we had these big paint brushes, and we had one of us would carry the bucket. Usually it was Carol because she had a big purse she'd put it in, and then I had the paintbrush. And so we'd go find where we wanted to. We'd talk it over, and we'd decide where we wanted to go that day and to put up posters. And so she would find a wall or whatever we wanted, and she would open up her purse, and I'd stick this big paintbrush in it, and then I'd put the stuff on the wall, and then we'd put the poster on it, smooth it out, and then we'd put more paste on it. And boy, once that dries and hardens, boy, it's really tough to take off. And I saw so many of our old posters, you know, still up, you know, like a week or years later, you know, there was our posters still up, but because they couldn't take them off, and sometimes they decide they just have to paint over them. But if you want to put a posters up, political posters up, and not get them taken down real fast, is to use cornstarch paste. And you can get that over the internet. Just put in cornstarch paste, and it is a good thing to do. We put out so many. I think one of our biggest coups is we put it on the back of a Nashville bus one time. I think it was Danny and Carol and myself were out postering, and we told Carol to go out and pretend she's going to get on the bus and dig through her thing for her wallet for money and everything. And so we were in the back, and we put up our couple flyers, and then Carol came back. She says, "Oh, I just told him I didn't have any money." And so we got our posters on his buses. It was pretty cool. But she was doing fine. You know, she was married, and she had some children, and she, like I said, she was still in the movement. And she said the Black Lives Matter movement really, really opened up people's eyes, and especially in Tennessee, and especially Nashville. And it was really good to hear that and to talk to them, because I hadn't talked to them in a long time. And I just, you know, it was just like talking about old times. It was just like we'd just done it the night before, you know. And it was so good, so good. And after I talked to those friends, I talked to this friend of mine. I have some friends from Vietnam that I still talk to, and one of them is Lennon. Lennon lives in North Carolina. He's a Black man that I met in Vietnam, and we just kind of, you know, stuck together talking and stuff, and I learned a lot, you know, from Lennon and my other brothers in Vietnam. And I called him in the Carolinas, and we were talking, and I asked him, you know, how things were going. He's been married, and his children were grown and gone, and he'd retired from his work. He'd worked, I think, as a fireman. I think he said he was a fireman. But Lennon was a short, heavyset guy, and when he first came, we didn't think he was going to make it. We didn't think he could, you know, he was pretty heavy. But he made it just fine. He was just a good guy. And we talked about his children, and I asked him what his kids thought about the Black Lives Movement, and he says they were very active in it too. They'd gone to a lot of rallies and everything, and he had too, but he said he's still pretty heavy. He had diabetes, and he had trouble walking, and stuff. He told me he had some serious health ailments. His heart was bad, and he had some trouble with cancer that he had beaten, and I just, you know, I was really worried about Lennon. And we just talked. We must have talked for an hour about things in Vietnam, about the things we did and things we'd seen and everything. And I talked to his wife for a little while, and she was really nice, and she was really worried about Lennon, because he was, you know, his health was really, really going bad. And when I talked to him again, she gave me the phone back to Lennon, and I was talking to him, and I said, do you get your health care from the Veterans Administration? He says, yeah. He says his cancer was one of them caused by Agent Orange, so he gets disability and all his health care free through the Veterans Administration's hospital. And that since this COVID-19 came in, it was, you know, you can still go up to the emergency room, but it's hard. You don't really get to go see a doctor anymore. And he was a little worried about that. And he he thought that that, you know, he was not feeling as good and that he was really worried about his health. And I told him, you know, that we'd keep in contact and we would talk, and I'd see, you know, if I could help him at all, you know, do anything at all, you know. And he says he was okay, that his VA counselor was giving him a lot of help, and he had gone through mental health with him and everything. So he said he was doing okay, but you could tell by his voice that he wasn't doing okay. So I'm going to really keep more in contact with Lennon now than I did before, because he was really a good friend. And, you know, we talked a lot in Vietnam about stuff, about him growing up and Carolinas and how he was treated and how he lived in a real dumpy house and how he was treated in school. And he was one of those guys that, you know, could read and write, but he did very poorly because schools didn't teach him, you know, to do that stuff very well. But he's a wonderful guy, and I really enjoyed talking to him, and I told him I missed him and everything, and he said he missed me. And so that was really good, talking to Danny and Carol and Lennon, and to know everybody's really involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. And I'm, you know, I learned a lot from my Black brothers and sisters that I will never ever forget, you know, never forget, and never, I will never let them down. I will fight for them till the day I die. I was also thinking, you know, about this country, about the racism in this country from the time it was taken from the Native Americans, you know, and well, they weren't using it anyway, so we'll just take it. You know, and I was thinking, you know, and then I thought about colonies. What about colonies? Do we have any colonies today? And I was surprised. I was surprised. But what we have is they don't call them colonies anymore. They call them either possessions or territories. And here's what we have: American Samoa, Guam, United States Virgin Islands. We have Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, the North Mariana Islands. Then we have these were territories: American Samoa, Guam, United States Virgin Islands, and then the Commonwealths were Puerto Rico and North Mariana Islands. But these are our possessions: Holland, Baker, and Jarvis Islands, Navassas Island, Johnston Island, Midway Atoll, Palmyra Atoll, Wake Islands, Guantanamo Bay. Let me turn this over and see what we got here. And then we have what's called Compacts of Free Association. Oh, we got Cayman Reef also. And then we have Compacts of Free Association: Republic of the Marshall Islands, Republic of Palau, Federated States of Micronesia. These are all things that we control, and they're in the, and I was looking where they were located, and they're all in the Pacific Ocean, and they're all close to where, if we do get into it with China about the South China Sea, they have all these bases that they can fly out of and do stuff out of. In Guam Island, in Guam, during the Vietnam War, they used Guam for their B-52s, and the B-52s flew out of Guam, and I think they flew out of Thailand, so they'll have those islands. And I've been really following what's going on in the South China Sea, and more they're building up their military presence, China and the U.S. and England and France and those places. And that something, China just did a military action program or training in between Taiwan and China with a huge you know, armada of their ships, and they're still going down into South China Sea on their islands that they've built up, and the United States is saying, no, that's not, you're not going to get away with this, and China keeps building up and putting all the, their a lot of their military down there. They have bombers and fighters. They have all the stuff, military stuff they need. They have their aircraft carriers. They have, now they have submarines. The United States is sending in their flotilla of stuff, and it's just a mess. Just a mess. You know, you all that money going into there. You know, they say we don't have any money for social things in this country, and all of a sudden they found those trillions of dollars that they could, you know, give out, and now they're putting all this money into the South China Sea. You know, where's that money coming from? It's our money. It's our money. And then you have this guy in the White House that is so unstable that I really worry about the South China Sea. I worry about that what's going to happen. And then you think about if that goes off, boy, that is not going to be nice. That is, just takes one mistake. Look what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1964 in Vietnam, when the USS, I can't remember what ship it was, fired on the Vietnamese patrol boats, and they fired back, and that was the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and that led the president at the time, Johnson, to escalate the war, bombing war, and the war in Vietnam, and the same thing could happen down in the South China Sea. It could happen in the South China Sea. Just any mess up could cause that. And I'm just worried that they're putting all this armament down in that area. You know, you think that people would be smarter than that, and they're not. They're not smarter than that. And then when you have this guy in the White House that really should never, he has no idea of what's going on. He, you know, the show before this one, they really did a great job. You know, KBOO does a great job on stuff, and Tammy and the others did a great job talking about Trump. And he has no business, you know, having control over this military. Because he doesn't think rational. He just doesn't think rational. And if he makes just one bad move, it's just going to put us all in a terrible shape. We just got to be real careful. And also last night on the Rachel Maddow show, I watched Mary Trump. She had written a book about her Uncle Donnie Trump. And everything that we had thought about this guy, she confirmed it. You know, she did a great job, and I'm really glad that she did it. And you know, and Rachel Maddow really asked her some really pointed questions, and she didn't blink an eye. She just told it like it was. You know, that he is a racist, he's a misogynist, and just the whole, everything we've been thinking about that guy has been proven by to be true. You know, by Mary Trump's book, and we just have to be, you know, on our toes, and we have to keep being in the streets. We have to keep going after them. You know, KBOO is a great station for that. And you know, if you want to support KBOO, you can go on our website, kboo.fm, and you can go on the website, and on the right hand corner there's a donate button. And you can donate, and or you can mail it in. I mail mine in, and I do it, you know, because you know it's our station, and do we need to keep it going, so we can have an alternative voice to what these so-called mainstream media is saying. They don't say anything really, you know. They just regurgitate what's coming out of the mouth of DC. So, you know, KBOO, we don't do that. So we don't do that. But I think that I'm going to finish for today. And we'll be back on August 21st at 9 a.m. And there it is. Thank you, Sonia, for helping me.
To the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with a saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all?
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Today on Wings. In 1920, the international oil industry first invaded the Amazon region. That and other extractive industries constantly press forward against indigenous rights and the rights of nature. Resistance is passed